Finally, to the Food and Drug Administration, which is embroiled in a surprisingly heated culinary standoff over French cheese. Regulators say that mimolette, an orange cheese that looks kind of like a small cantaloupe, cannot be imported because it contains too many cheese mites. But as Dina Pritchett reports, the mites are what makes the cheese mimolette.
Benoit Duviton is the North American representative for Isigny, a major French cheesemaker. And since March, all of his mimolette shipments, about a ton of cheese, have been held up because of one small problem. One very small problem.
Well, if you look, like here, all you see, like the dust, that's cheese mites.
Cheese mites, which Duviton is scraping off the rind of mimolette, are microscopic bugs. They're mostly a mild industry nuisance that are brushed off aged cheeses. But for mimolette, they're actually encouraged.
The mimolette has been made this way since the 17th century, with cheese mite eating the rind. They really affect on the nuttiness of the taste.
When the cheese is done aging, the mites are removed. But there are always some left behind. And now the FDA is cracking down. They don't want to see more than 6 mites per square inch, which for mimolette is an impossible standard.
They say the product, because of the mites, is not proper for human consumption. What we think is like it's been 20 years without an issue, and also we have absolutely no proof that the mites are bad for you.
There have been documented cases of some types of allergic reactions.
Rachel Dutton is a microbiologist at Harvard University, where she runs a cheese lab.
But it's only been found, as far as I can tell, in people who actually work with large numbers of these mite populations.
While we might not like to think about bugs on our foods, bacteria, yeasts, molds, and cheese mites, Dutton says that we really do depend on them.
There definitely are microbes that can spoil food and make it either bad for you to eat or just sort of gross. But anytime you eat a piece of cheese or a bite of yogurt, have a piece of bread or a glass of wine, these are all examples of foods fermented by different types of microbes.
And these microbes are everywhere. Cheese lovers are worried about what the FDA limit could mean for other aged cheeses, which almost all have some mites. But if it's just mimolette, is it really a big deal? Well, it definitely is to the French. They aren't rioting in the streets yet, but there are stories on French radio and television, and YouTube videos where other French cheeses come together in support of their fallen compatriot.
Coulommiers, Epoisses, Bleu d'Auvergne, Beaufort, Livarot, Reblochon, Abondance, Mont-d'Or.
But for the rest of us, like many Americans, Portland cheesemonger Sasha Davies has no problem, say, reaching for a slice of Gouda instead.
I can find other cheeses that touch on different flavor notes that I miss about an aged mimolette.
But Davies knows it's really not about the caramely notes or lactic tang or even mites.
There are cheeses that, you know, even though I think they taste delicious, they tug at my heartstrings, either because I love the person who makes them or I have this great memory of being in a special place. Food is never really just food.
And for those who grew up in northern France, like cheese rep Benoit Duviton, mimolette is one of those foods that has an emotional pull. You can hear it as he unpacks his final shipment.
That's going to be my last mimolette until I go back to France. Rest in peace.
Duviton is still trying to figure out what to do with his detained cheese and what to do in the future. But for now, he's savoring one last taste of mimolette. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchup.
Please, somebody ring the cheese alarm.
Robin Hitchcock, and you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
And it's time again for Cook Your Cupboard, which is our new food project on Morning Edition. You submit photos of food in your kitchen, stuff lying around in the cupboard, in the refrigerator, stuff you don't know what to do with, and then you get to come on air to get advice from a famous chef, if your submission is chosen. Today's famous chef is Yotam Ottolenghi. He's an Israeli chef with a chain of restaurants in London that specialize in Middle Eastern and Mediterranean cuisine. He is also the author of the best-selling book, Plenty. Welcome to the program.
Hi, good to be here.
We're going to bring in now Laurel Ruma of Medford, Massachusetts, outside Boston. She sent us a submission. Welcome to the program to you.
Thank you.
Pretty good timing for you, I guess, because you had just, like, what, renovated your kitchen, if I'm not mistaken?
That's right. We actually took on a major project in August, and I've been slowly bringing in boxes of strange food that I picked up along my travels.
You, what, hear about different foods? People serve you different things? You check in local food stores? What do?
Yep, all of those things. So when you come to Boston, the good place to go is the North End, where there are a number of Italian grocery stores. Mm. So while I was there, I picked up some chickpea flour. To my shame, I've hung on to it now for a while, and I just had no idea what to do with it.
Okay, so that is the first thing, chickpea flour. What is it?
Basically, it's dried chickpeas that have been pulverized into a flour. And it's gluten-free. Chickpea flour has a wonderful flavor, and I particularly like using it in a kind of Indian-inspired dishes. So, for instance, fried cauliflower with mint, and I serve it with a tamarind dipping sauce. It's got garlic, many spices, ginger, cumin, ground coriander, mustard seeds, some curry powder, and some egg and water. And that mix of the cauliflower plus the batter with the chickpea flour is really, really, really delicious.
Wow. I mean, as you talk, I can already just smell the Indian food. This is the first of the ingredients that Laurel has come up with. You also have a couple of other ingredients, mystery ingredients that have ended up in your kitchen.
So also from the North End of Boston, harissa. I picked up a tube and promptly forgot about it.
Harissa is really one of my favorite ingredients. It's one of the most amazing chili pastes around. It's aromatic, it's strong. So really, if you have one of these tubes that are imported from Tunisia, you can use it to marinate fish, to marinate lamb, to marinate vegetables, and then grill them or bake them in the oven. Really, it just gives the most fantastic aromatic flavor. One other thing to do with it, it makes a wonderful salad dressing. I normally just whisk it briefly together with olive oil, with lemon juice, with some additional garlic, maybe salt and pepper, and it's just the best thing you can do.
Laurel, you're getting some ideas there in Medford, Massachusetts?
Oh, absolutely.
Pretty spicy as well, sounds like.
Yeah, love spice. Bring it on.
Laurel, this is awesome. You have already taken us to India and to North Africa with random stuff from your kitchen, and you've still got one ingredient to go.
So the last ingredient would be black chia seeds. And I know chia seeds are supposed to be very healthy for you, but I'm not really sure what to do with them.
Laurel, I have to tell you that you put me into trouble because there's not many ingredients in this world that I can say that I really don't like. And chia seeds are one of those ingredients. I really find the texture very off-putting. It's like it's quite slimy. I don't know why anyone would eat that, but I guess
I've been sprinkling them into my partner's oatmeal in the morning, so he'll have flaxseed and chia seeds, so he hasn't
missed
a slimy bit of it yet, so we'll see.
Oh, well, that's another thing you can do with mysterious foods. Just kind of slip them into somebody else's food and see what happens. Yo, Tom Ottolenghi, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
And we also spoke with Laurel Ruma of Medford, Massachusetts. Thanks to you.
Thank you, Steve.
Now you can submit your own baffling kitchen items with a chance to come on the radio with a chef. Head to npr.org/cupboard.
With our video pick of the week, hi, Flora.
Hi. It's multitasking's, you know, what goes best with multitasking, a big cup of coffee. That's what our video is about this week, our continuing coverage of this hard-hitting, serious issue. What is the science in your morning, Joe?
Mm-hmm.
So our video this week was put together by video producer Jenny Woodward. And this one goes into the gear.
The gear.
The gadgets for serious, really serious coffee drinkers.
Mm-hmm.
So you may have seen these before in these fancy schmancy places. Like we went Everyman Espresso in New York City. You know, the Wood Neck, the Chemex, And it's like microscopes. You know, you wouldn't use your scanning electron when you really needed a confocal.
Of course not.
That's what the baristas will tell you anyway. So you can look at our video and find out, you know, which tools give you different flavors and aspects to your coffee.
Yeah, it's a great video because not only does it explain which of these fancy coffee makers do what, but it also explains how the coffee is affected by how long it's in contact with the beans, the size of the beans.
Right. So this was something I didn't know. The reason why you want to have evenly ground coffee, so all the little particles are the same size, is because you're doing an extraction. It's just a little chemistry experiment in your coffee maker. And if the particles are smaller, you have more surface area to the amount of to the particle, and they extract faster. And you get the kind of yucky flavors that come out with a longer extraction.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow here with Flora Lichtman talking about her coffee experiment, sort of. You compared a lot of different coffees in this video, right?
We looked at a lot of different tools, and we spoke with Harold McGee, who's written a lot about food and science, and he gave us a lot of ahas in this video, and I think we have a clip of one that we could play. And this was something that I didn't even know to wonder about until he mentioned it, which is when you take coffee grounds and you pour hot water over them, you may have noticed that they bubble a little bit. Have you ever seen this
before?
Yeah,
all the time, yeah.
So I've seen it too, but I never thought to ask why. But Harold has the answer for us.
Reason for that is that one of the products of the roasting process is carbon dioxide. In fact, the beans pop like popcorn during the roasting process. They enlarge in size, they become porous and brittle, and in all those pores is lots and lots of carbon dioxide gas, which is what caused them to pop in the first place, the creation and expansion of that gas. And that CO2 is locked into the pore structure of the beans. So if you grind the beans up freshly, then, of course, you break up a lot of those pores, but there's still some that are there. And you pour the water on, and that CO2 then bursts through and forms lots and lots of bubbles. If you've ground the coffee days or weeks or months ahead of time, then most of that CO2 is dissipated, and you pour the same hot water on, and it just sits there. It's not as lively. So that's one good way of telling how fresh your coffee is.
That's great. You know, the reason why you don't see it these days is because you put your grounds into a machine. Back in the old days, before you were born, we had these Melitas. Remember, these used to take a hot pot of water and pour it into a cone of coffee.
It's coming back, Ira.
Let's go. Like vinyl records.
Bell bottoms.
Right. And you watch it foam up all the time. And this is the first time in 30 years I've heard a great explanation for that.
Yeah, it's like the fizz in your soda. I never knew.
Yeah, and it's up there on a video pick of the week. Great explanation, a great video. It's up there on our website. If you want to see, maybe you're shopping for another coffee maker, right? And you want to
compare
the brands, and there are so many different ways.
That's right.
One thing that was missing is that French press. The French press was not included.
Thank you for bringing this up. I asked about the French press because I used to have a French press, which may give you some indication of what we heard, but apparently the French press is totally poo-pooed by the baristas we talked to. They were like, we wouldn't even put it up on our list of tools. No, because I think it's very hard to get an even extraction. You need the even particle size, and then to get the timing right, because you're just letting it sit there, is challenging.
It's amazing. And you learn about all the timing, about how long the water should be in contact with the grounds and things like that, and the website up there in Science.
There's a whole series.
You could spend
many minutes.
Yes, multitasking over the coffee. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Flora Lichtman. It's up there in our video pick of the week, and up there all with all of our hundreds of other videos that Flora has put together. That's about all the time we have for now. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today. We needed it from NPR librarian Kim Molesky. If you missed any part of this program, you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcast. We have Flora's videos up there and up on our website. You can subscribe to them. You can take them with you on our iPhone and Android apps and listen and watch them all anytime you'd like to see them. Or go to our website and join our mailing list at sciencefriday.com. You can also tweet us all week long. We have over 250,000 Twitter followers now on Science Friday in our club. We want you to join us. And if you like us on Facebook, go to our Facebook page and hit that little like button. We had a great time here in Stanford. I want to thank you all for your help. Thank you all for coming out to see us today. And we'll see you next week in New York. I'm Ira Flatow in Stanford.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Police in New Orleans are investigating a shooting that took place yesterday during a Mother's Day parade. New Orleans Police Chief Ronald Serpas says law enforcement is still investigating the matter.
It appears that these two or three people, just for a reason unknown to us, started shooting at, towards, or in the crowd. It was over in just a couple seconds. Police were everywhere.
We'll be following this story, so please stay tuned to your public radio station and NPR.org for more information as the story develops. But now we'd like to turn to another story out of New Orleans, an effort to expand that city's food choices. You might wonder why that's necessary in a city that is world-renowned for its cuisine. But our next guest tells us that the Big Easy also has food deserts. Those are neighborhoods without ready access to fresh, healthy food. And that prompted him to try to do something about it. We're talking here about actor Wendell Pierce. He stars in HBO's New Orleans drama, Tremé, playing musician Antoine Baptiste. Here's a clip.
I need your love so badly. I love you, oh, so madly. But I don't stand a ghost of a chance with you.
And Wendell Pierce, along with his partners, have invested in a chain of convenience stores and a full-service grocery store, which has just opened, and he is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you grew up in New Orleans. Do you remember food deserts, as they are now called? I mean, we didn't call them that then, but do you remember this being an issue back when you were growing up?
It wasn't a major issue. It wasn't an issue for me, definitely. But in the Lower Ninth Ward, you know, there hasn't been a decent grocery store in 20 years. So just as I was leaving New Orleans for New York, it started to become an issue. And it's something that, for me, growing up in New Orleans, where so much of the culture is based around food, is unacceptable.
Well, how did this happen? Do you know? I mean, how did it come about that there were areas where it's just hard to get fresh food?
Well, it's something that's happening all over the country, and American industry has decided that certain neighborhoods, for whatever reasons, aren't viable, aren't some projected area that they should be investing in, where they have decided to stand on the sidelines and not kind of participate in the economic exchange that happens with their consumer base there. And what happens in these underserved areas, people have demonstrated their loyalty to the stores by having to travel a distance, showing loyalty to their brand and to the product. And all they ask in return is that those same American stores come to their neighborhoods, but they choose to stand on the sidelines. And that's where we are different. At Sterling Farms, we're saying we're stepping up to the plate. We're actually going to those areas that are underserved because we see them as emerging markets.
Did Hurricane Katrina make it worse?
Yeah, it did, you know, because so many people were displaced. So many neighborhoods were destroyed. 80% of the city was destroyed. And then as I returned home and started to rebuild my neighborhood in Pontchartrain Park, I realized that you can't ask people to come back if you don't have the commercial strips coming back, the commercial districts coming back. And that's when I started to do the research and realized that so much of New Orleans was also suffering from food deserts.
What was the most difficult thing about getting this all done?
Well, first of all, the mechanics and logistics of opening a grocery store. As an actor, I can tell you, I had a quick and sharp learning curve. It's a lot of work, a lot of moving parts, but the most difficult part is making sure that everybody was on board when it comes to the banking institutions, my partners, and everyone, you know, participating in the business sense to make sure that it was a viable idea to them, to show them to the economic benefits, and to see those areas, as I said before, as an opportunity and not something that you should be adverse to.
Was the issue specific to New Orleans or specific to the kind of neighborhood you're trying to serve? I mean, by that I mean, is it that when you first approach people who have the wherewithal to get this done and to invest in these kinds of businesses, is it that they don't believe that there could possibly be a food desert in New Orleans, or do they feel that the people there don't want fresh food? What's the mentality is that's the first hurdle that you have to overcome?
The mentality is they know that they have a captured consumer, you know, a consumer that they know has to travel to get food. They don't have to invest in that neighborhood. They don't have to go to that area. And they still know that they can count on that consumer coming to their store. And so when that happens, there's sort of an economic apathy that happens and says, listen, I don't have to even make an investment of time, energy, of brick and mortar, and go into a community, that community has to come to me because they have no other choice. And so it puts them in a position of no competition and also knowing that those consumers are going to come to their store. The one thing that happens now is the consumers realize that if a store takes the chance and the risk that we've taken to come into the neighborhood, well, we woke our competitors up. Our competitors have all of a sudden come to the store. You know, at one point there was one grocer who came there and said, this may be some trifle for Wendell Pierce, but I'm a grocer who's been at the game for 30 years, and who is he to open a store? All of a sudden, he had competition that he didn't have before because he knew those consumers, as underserved as they were, they still had that pent-up demand and that they would travel to his store. Now we're giving them the alternative, like you and I have, mm-hmm. just walk out our door and go to our neighborhood grocery destination, and then he now has to compete.
What I was going to ask you is, what was the key to getting this done? Was it your participation? I mean, was it the fact that there are people like you with a track record? I mean, you have a track record now, having worked in housing development and redeveloping mm-hmm. the neighborhood. Do you think it was you? What do you think was the key to overcoming the resistance?
I think there's a combination of advocacy from people in the neighborhood who said, please come and help us bring the industries and the stores that we want in our neighborhood, especially a grocery store. It's just my personal advocacy and belief that New Orleans is too great of a city and these communities are too great of neighborhoods not to have all the services that I take for granted when I come to New York and when I, you know, go to California and all the services that I had. It's the memory of that Friday night grocery trip that I used to take with my mother. It was the town square, you know, men and women getting off of work, and you would see them at our neighborhood grocery store for, you know, a little 8-year-old boy that was, you know, the fishmonger and the butcher. These were, you know, common people in my life on the beginning of my weekend, and I felt as though that was something culturally that everybody should have in their neighborhood to see that it goes away.
I'm laughing because this is really where I find things out, at the grocery store on Friday night.
It really is.
This is where I find out what needs to happen or what's going on in the neighborhood. That's where it all is.
and so just seeing that and then also just convincing people that it's actually a viable business plan and model. And I think putting all of that on the table and whatever celebrity I brought to it helped to define the issue and bring some light to the issue.
So your first full-service store has been open for a few weeks now. How has the neighborhood responded? How is it going?
Oh, the neighborhood has responded wonderfully. They're so happy to have a decent, clean store, quality product, you know, world-class customer service, but more importantly, affordable.
Well, keep us posted.
I will.
What's your favorite aisle?
My favorite aisle is aisle number one, the produce. Fresh vegetables, fresh fruit. Something I need to eat more of, and we all should eat more of. And just bringing a decent grocery store to the neighborhood is something that I'm proudest of.
If I pop in and see you in the bakery aisle, I'm going to talk about you.
I'll be greeting you at the front door.
Okay. Wendell Pierce is an actor and now grocer, investor in Sterling Express and Sterling Farms. That is a chain of convenience stores and full-service grocery stores now serving New Orleans. And he was kind enough to join us from NPR Studios in New York City, where we caught up with him. Wendell Pierce, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you. Have a great day.